So there was a mother who once took her young son because she wanted to culture him. And so she took him to museums and places where they had art and ancient, you know, vessels and ancient works and things that, he could see how people have worked so hard and craftsmen had worked so hard over time. So she was bringing him to different museums, and she walked into a museum one day with him that had all kinds of collector's items from all around the world, precious things, old things, invaluable things that were priceless. And she lost track of him for 1 minute. You know how it goes, right? But she didn't realize she'd lost track of him until she heard the scream. Moms, you know the scream, right? Moms can identify the scream of their child. So she heard the scream and then turned and saw her little boy had his arm in this Chinese vase. And it was stuck. And he's pulling and pulling and swinging it around, and he can't get his arm out. And so she runs over, and in that kind of mom yell whisper thing, you know they do? What are you doing? How did you get your hand in there? And she's pulling on it, yanking on it, trying to get his hand out, but it won't come out. And finally, some people start to notice, and they quietly try to help so they don't get in trouble. And people are trying to pull, but now the kid is screaming, "Ow, you're pulling off my hand!" And then the museum curators and all the people who work there, they come in, and they're like, "Wait, stop everyone." And they get, you know, pillows and everything ready and a box ready. And they're pulling and pulling, and the kid is screaming and crying because it will not come off his hand. And finally, someone said, wait a minute. It's a Chinese vase. Maybe it's like one of those Chinese finger things, right? You know the Chinese finger traps? You stick your fingers in it and you pull, that won't come off. He said, so try pushing his arm in. It didn't help. And so the kid is screaming and yelling and screaming because he can't get it out. And finally, after a long, long time, they made the horrible decision to break the vase. And so they get the box ready with pillows. Maybe we can break it in such a way that we'll be able to crazy glue it back together. I don't know. But they break the vase. And then the mom gasps in horror as she sees the boy's hand, because it's clenched like this. And she says to him, "What's in your hand?" And everyone stares as the little boy turns and opens his hand, and there's a penny. He had seen a penny in the vase and stuck his hand in to get it. And in his foolish innocence, didn't know any better, didn't know to open his hand. He was not letting go of that penny. He was holding on to it, and that's why his hand wouldn't come out, because he was gripping a penny. And that's why there's signs around all the museums today, wherever you go, that says, "Please don't throw coins in here," right? Because that's what kids do. That's what this kid did. And he got his penny at the expense of something invaluable. And we make the same mistake in our lives too, don't we? Settling for a life that is less than what God has for us. We grab the penny and don't ever realize the invaluable treasure that God has for us that's within our grasp. But when you meet God, you realize that you've been settling for a life that is so much less than what he has for you. And all you need to do is seek him first, not the pennies. Last week, I told you the story of Abraham. Actually, I told you the story of Moses telling the story of Abraham, because Moses was telling the Israelites about Abraham, who was their great, 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 infinity great grandfather, generations and generations ago, because they had been slaves for 400 years in Egypt. Everybody remembers there had been a famine, and Joseph led them, brought them down to Egypt, and Joseph was the great, great, great grandson of Abraham. And so, but then they ended up slaves because they got so big and powerful, the Egyptians got afraid of them, and so they enslaved them, and for 400 years, they'd been in Egypt as slaves. And you know what happens when you've been doing something for 400 years? You become that thing. It becomes your identity. And so in their minds, they're slaves, and they are in danger of forgetting forever who they truly are. And so Moses reminds them who they are and who their purpose is by writing down the stories of the creation and of the fall and of the flood and of the rebellion at the Tower of Babel. and of God's response. That's what Moses is doing here. He's reminding them who they are as they get ready to re-enter the land that God had promised Abraham. Right? It's important we recognize this. This is our history. Right? This is God's plan and God's response. Because the world was forgetting who God was. We had rebelled against him. God made us in his image to be like him, and instead we turned around and started trying to make gods in our image. And we were almost completely lost. But then God had a plan that would ultimately lead to us knowing who God truly is. And that plan started with a man named Abraham. And God called Abraham and used Abraham and his offspring to show the world who I am. That was God's plan. Let them see through the way he interacts with Israel how God is just and merciful and faithful even when they're not, how God is gracious and gives even when we don't deserve it, and how God is perfect love. And through Abraham and his descendants, and ultimately down the line through Jesus, in whom we see the fullness of God. That was God's plan, so that the world would know who he is. And that's why it's so important that we read the Bible and see who God is and how God acts and how God behaves. And we don't just make it up all out of what we think and feel. No, you can actually go see who God is. That's why he made this covenant with Abraham, so that he could show who he is and ultimately show who he is through Jesus. And so God made this covenant we talked about last week with Abraham. He said, I'm going to make you a great nation by giving you descendants as many as the stars in the sky, which is like more than you could ever count. And he said, I'm going to give you this land, I'm going to give you territory, and I'm going to bless the nations through you. He said, and then last week we saw how God did all those things in Abraham's life, and we saw how Abraham learned that when Abraham met God, he discovered that obeying God is worth any price, because God is all you need. Well, Abraham eventually died. And that left the question, now what? Because there's no guarantee that the next generation is going to follow in the footsteps of the parents, is there? Right? There's no guarantee that the next generation will follow in the footsteps of those who've gone before. In our culture, it's actually almost like a negative thing for someone to follow in the footsteps of their parent. Right? It's like, no, everyone's supposed to blaze their own trail and find their own way. That's the message I always heard growing up. Blaze your own trail, find your own way. And maybe that's why so many people feel lost today. We've forgotten how to follow in the footsteps of those who've gone before us and benefit from what they've learned and what they've known. What's Isaac going to do? This son that Abraham waited forever to have, right? What's Isaac going to do? Is he going to grab for pennies, or is he going to reach for what God has for him? And so we're going to look at Isaac's story today. Isaac's story is much shorter than Abraham's story in the Bible. And his story actually, in many ways, mirrors the things that happened to Abraham. A lot of the same things that happened to Abraham happened to Isaac. So much so that some commentators have looked at this and said, oh, these are just Abraham's stories. And somebody came and slapped Isaac's name on them and said, oh, yeah, and this happened to Isaac, like an afterthought. But they missed the point. Moses wanted to show the Israelites and us how similar Isaac was to Abraham, and use the similarities as a way of comparing the two of them and answering the question, how does each successive generation maintain this covenant relationship with God? If you're a parent, you should be wondering about that. If you're a kid, you should be wondering about that. How does each generation maintain this covenant relationship with God? Because there they were, many, many generations removed, and Moses is telling them God's promise still stands. That's why he rescued us from Egypt. His promise still stands, and here we go. We're going to go get it. Each generation, though, has to learn to follow God in their own right. And hopefully, you know, each generation can help the one following after it. But the truth is that we all start in the same place, and that is meeting God. We all start in the same place. And our journeys will look very similar because it's all about coming to know God. That's why Abraham and Isaac look so similar, because they're following a journey toward God. So here's what happened when Isaac met God. Go to Genesis chapter 26. You can follow along on the screen or in the app or in your own Bible. Genesis chapter 26. We're just going to walk through his story in Genesis 26 and see what happened when Isaac met God and see what he learned about following God and what was important in life. So Genesis chapter 26, we're going to start in verse 1. It says, now there was a famine in the land. besides the previous famine in Abraham's time. And Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands, and I'll confirm the oath I swore to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and will give them all these lands. And through your offspring, all the nations on the earth will be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and did everything I required of him, keeping my commands, my decrees, and my instructions." So Isaac stayed in Gerar. So it starts with a famine again, right? Starts with a famine again, just like what it hit in Abraham's day. And Isaac goes to this Philistine area, and the king there is named Abimelech. And you might remember, some of you who are sharp, super sharp, you remember Abimelech was the king when Abraham was there, but this is a couple generations later. At least, at the very least, 40 years have passed, probably more like 80. A long time has passed. This is a different Abimelech, a descendant, and Isaac is trying to deal with this famine. What are we supposed to do? And God appears to him and says, "Whatever you do, don't go down to Egypt. Stay in this land. If you obey me in this, then I will affirm my covenant that I made with your father Abraham. If you obey me, I'll affirm this covenant and make it with you too." Right? That's the condition that starts here. If you obey me, I'll confirm this. And so then God tells him, you know, don't go to Egypt to escape. Stay here in the land. And Isaac did great. He obeyed. He stayed there in the land. He didn't run down to Egypt. So, phew, good. He's following in his dad's footsteps. But wait, sometimes following in your dad's footsteps isn't a great thing, right? Don't worry. My dad's here. I won't tell any stories. I saw him get a little nervous there. Verse 7, when the men of that place asked him about his wife, he said, "Oh, her? She's my sister." Does that sound familiar? Abraham and his dad did that. Because he was afraid to say she's my wife, he thought the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebecca because she's so beautiful. I did that this week with Christina at a restaurant. I said, no, she's my sister, so they wouldn't kill me. Take her. I didn't, but that's a good idea. I'm going to do that. Don't tell her. Look, some of you like to run to her and tell her stuff after service. Don't, because I'm going to do that this week, and she's going to be embarrassed. So he says, no, she's my sister, so that way they won't kill her because she's so beautiful. And here's why that works. Because if she's his wife, then the only way to get to her is to kill him. But if she's his sister, then they just have to give him stuff, right? And so he says, she's my sister. And when he'd been there a long time, Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, is looking out a window one day, and he sees Isaac caressing and kissing his sister. Well, it's not his sister, though. It's Rebekah, his wife. And Abimelech calls Isaac in and says, "She's your wife. I really hope she's your wife. Why did you say she's my sister?" And Isaac said, "Well, I thought you might kill me on account of her, because look at her." And then Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the men might well have slept with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech gave orders to all the people. "Anyone who harms this man or his wife will surely be put to death." So what does that tell us right now about what's going on with Isaac? One, it's good he's obeying God, but two, not so good. He's not trusting God fully. He's using his own manipulations to try and safeguard and make sure God's promises happen. And look, here's the deal. You can't make God's promises happen. You can only obey and then receive them. You can't make God's promises happen. You've got to obey him, seek him, and they will happen. When you try to make them happen, bad stuff happens. So he tells the same lie his father told, and when his dad told that lie, they ended up giving him a lot of money and a lot of stuff. This time, Isaac doesn't get a lot of money, but what he gets is an order of protection. The king says, "No one is allowed to harm a hair on their heads. You just let them be." So for the whole time they're living there, in Gerar, in that area, they're under the king's protection. And so Isaac goes on, verse 12, he plants crops in that land, and the same year, it produces 100-fold. Like for every seed he plants, he gets 100 plants, right? So huge blessing, because the Lord blessed him, it says. Verse 13 says, the man, Isaac, became rich, and his wealth continued to grow until he became very, very wealthy. And he had so many flocks and herds, and servants that the Philistines envied him. And so here's what they did. All the wells that his father's servants had dug up in the time of his father Abraham, the Philistines went and stopped up, filling them with earth. So God is blessing Isaac now because Isaac is obeying God and staying put, just as God promised. Even though it's been a famine, God is blessing him and he's producing. And everyone around is getting ticked off at it because they're not getting the same results he is. They're getting mad at him. But they can't touch Isaac and Rebekah, so they do this passive-aggressive thing or sort of aggressive-aggressive thing, and they just plug up all the wells because wells equal water, water equals life, right? We don't think about it too much. We turn on our tap, and it's there. But then, you know, the water goes down in your town, on your street, and what do? You freak out, right? For them, they had to go searching, and you find water, you live there. Right, so they start stopping up all these wells to try and, because if they stop up the wells, that's going to stop up the growth of his crops. That's going to stop up the growth of his flocks. It's going to stop God's blessing in his life. Because without water, you got nothing. Everything is built around water. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to stop God's blessing. And this isn't just about petty envy, right? That's not why Moses is telling the Israelites this as they get ready to go into the promised land and return here. That's not why we need to hear it. This is about a covenant passing from generation to generation. These are the wells Abraham dug. That's what Moses is trying to subtly point out to us. These are the wells his father dug that God blessed him with. And these people are coming in and trying to stop it up. They're trying to cut him off from God's blessing so that this covenant doesn't pass from one generation to the next. And what Moses wants the Israelites to understand, and you and I to understand, it's bigger than just the thing being plugged up. This is opposition to God's covenant promise. This world will oppose God's promises. And from this point on in the story now, we're going to watch carefully, because from this point on in the story, wells are going to play a huge part. Wells are going to play a huge part in teaching Isaac a lesson about pursuing God and not settling. So, verse 16, Abimelech says to Isaac, listen, move away. You've become too big for us, too powerful for us, so go away. Now, this is scary because where's he going to go? The land is still in famine, and so they're sending him out. And so Isaac moves away, and he encamps in the Valley of Gerar where he settled there, and he reopens all those wells that they had stopped up, that his father had dug. First thing he does is reopens all those wells and he renames them the same names his father had given them. Great sign that this covenant is lasting and it's going to continue. He renames the wells the same thing, stating basically ownership of them. He starts there, but then he keeps moving, right? And starts digging new wells. Verse 19, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water, living water there. But the herders of Gerar quarreled with the herders of Isaac, and they said, no, this water is ours. And so he named the well Essek, which means like dispute, because they disputed with him. So he finds a well. It says living water. It's probably an artesian well. It's one of those wells that where it's not just it sits there and you have to drop a bucket. It's one of those wells where the water like spurts out like an oil rig, right? And so they find a well like that. But then the shepherds from the Philistines come and say, nope, this is our water. You can't take this water. And so he doesn't want to argue. He moves on. He wants a place where he can have water and just have peace and no one bothering him. Right? Because the most important thing, first on the list, is find water. You find water, you plant your tent there, and you live there. You got to find water, and then that's where you're going to live. But he also wants peace so they can grow. So he moves on, and verse 21, they dig another well, but they quarreled over that one also, so he named it Sitnah for quarreling. So again, they search for water. Water's the first thing, top of the list. Got to find it. But when they try to settle there, there's quarreling. He doesn't want that. He wants water and he wants peace. And so they move on. Verse 22, they dig a third well. So it started with his father's wells. Then he dug two wells that people fought over. Then he digs a fourth well. And no one quarrels over it. So he names it Rehoboth, which is space, peace, room to grow. And says, now the Lord has given us room and we will flourish in the land. And it's like, finally, they dig this new well, and now they have what they need most to survive, water. and no one bothers them so they can just have peace. And Isaac believes God has given him this space because of two reasons. He found water and he found no opposition. So he settled there. And so what you see with each of these wells is that Isaac is looking for a place with water and no opposition. And to him, that is what he needs. And that's all he needs. That's God's blessing. That's enough for him. A place with water and no one to oppose him. And this is what most of us are looking for, right? We're looking for a place to settle down somewhere where we'll have what we need to live, a good job, a decent home, and no one bothering us. You know, good neighbors, all that stuff. We want enough to provide for our needs and peace. That's what most of us are looking for. It's called the suburbs, right? So the question is, where's God? Where's God? For some reason, and Moses doesn't say it, it just kind of jumps right into it. Isaac gets up and leaves Rehoboth and goes to Beersheba. Beersheba is where he grew up, where his father had settled down and pitched his tents. And he gets up and goes there. I don't know if it's to visit or what, but he goes there. And while he's in Beersheba, I want you to pay close attention to what happens because he meets God again in Beersheba. And this is the key. Verse 23. From there, he goes up to Beersheba. And while he's there that night, the Lord appears to him. He hadn't appeared to him in any of those other places. But here the Lord appears to him, verse 24, and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you, and I will bless you, and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. There he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well. So just like his father Abraham, Isaac meets God again. And this time, God makes an unconditional covenant. It's not, if you obey me, then I'll do this. He says, nope, here's the covenant. There's nothing for Isaac to obey first now. God's true to his word. He reaffirms this covenant with Isaac. I'm going to bless you with many, many descendants. I'm going to give you this land, and I'm going to make you a blessing to the nations. And then look at verse 25. What does it say happened after Isaac met God? Isaac built an altar there, called on the name of the Lord. There he pitched his tent, and there his servants dug a well. This becomes Isaac's home, not because they found water here, but because he found God here. This is where he met God. In all the other places, the well was first. Dig a well, we need water. Find water, then we'll live there. Isaac meets God and the pattern changes all around. Now the place where I'm going to live, the place where I'm going to put my tent up and live is where I meet God. I meet God first, settle there, and then they go dig for water. And as they're digging, looking for water, Abimelech comes. Verse 26, meanwhile, Abimelech comes from Gerar with Ahuzath and his personal advisor and Phicol, the commander of the forces. And Isaac says, why are you coming to me? You were hostile to me and you sent me away. And they answer him and they say, well, look, we saw clearly the Lord was with you. So we said there ought to be a sworn agreement between us and you. Let us make a treaty with you that you will do us no harm, just as we did not harm you, but always treated you well and sent you away peacefully. Except for when we stopped up your wells, but never mind that. And look at this, and now you are blessed by the Lord. They recognize that in surviving this wilderness trek, going from place to place, chased from the wells, and in coming to Beersheba where he settles because he met God there, they say, now you are blessed by the Lord. There is no denying the marks on the life of a person who is not grabbing at pennies, but is pursuing God's blessing. There's no denying the marks of that. It's evident, and it was evident to them, and they recognized it. And so verse 30, Isaac makes a feast for them, and they eat and they drink, and the next morning they get up and they make this oath together. Isaac sends them on their way, and they have peace. Verse 32, that day, Isaac's servants come, and they tell him about the well they had dug, and they say, we found water. And he called it Sheba, and to this day, the name of the town has been Beersheba. He met God there. That's why he put up his tents there to live, because he met God, not because he got water. And in pursuing God first, the water came. God provided. His father Abraham had named the same town Sheba decades earlier. He had made a treaty with the king of the Philistines decades earlier. And he named it Sheba because Sheba means seven and Sheba means oath. It means both things. And in Abraham's case, he named it Sheba because he gave seven animals as proof that this was his well that he had dug up. When you come here and Isaac's servants dig a new well, he names it seven because seven means oath. And this oath brought peace that ratified that God was providing for them and giving them a place in the land. So in all this, what did Isaac learn that was so important for the Israelites to know as they were getting ready to go into the promised land that God had promised Abraham and Isaac? Isaac learned this. When you meet God, you realize that you've been settling for so much less than what he has for you. And all you need to do is seek him first. Hey, look, there were people with Moses as they're leaving slavery in Egypt and heading to the promised land. There are people with Moses who want to go back to Egypt and be slaves again. Talk about settling, right? We do the similar thing. We go back to things that enslaved us, habits and sins that enslaved us. Let's not pretend they're stupid and we're smart. We do the same thing by returning to enslaving behaviors and relationships that pull us away from what God has for us. We grab at pennies instead of grabbing for what God has. So we're just like them. And Moses is trying to tell them, don't settle, right? It's been 40 years they've been wandering around. They're about to go into this promised land. And Moses is saying, look, don't just stop in the first good place you find. Right? Don't just say, oh, this is okay. I'm good here. And settle. Because we don't want to stop until we've met God. And when we meet God, then we know where he wants us to be. That's where we will live. Not in the place we find convenience and peace. I want to live in the place where I find God. And then let everything else be added after that. Isaac almost settled. Lot settled. You guys remember his story? That didn't go so well. Let's not rush in and settle. All right, let's go to where we meet God. Seek God first and trust that everything will be added onto that. Because you don't add God on top of your life like a cherry on top of a sundae. We need him first. When you meet God, you realize that you've been settling for so much less than what he has for you. And all you need to do is seek him first. So think about this with me this morning. What have you been seeking in your life? What are you looking for first? Have you been digging wells first? Are you going wherever you can get more money first? The best place to live first? And then settling there and trying to put God on top of it? Or are you seeking God first and then building the rest of your life around meeting God? This is a journey every one of us must take, and none of us can take it for the other. Parents, you can't take this journey for your kids. Kids, your parents can't take this journey for you. You've got to meet God. We each have to meet God, and it starts there. And then it's comprised of pursuing God. And so our journeys are going to look very similar. Let's not pretend we're that different, right? Even though we're maybe generations apart, we're living very similar lives as we pursue God. And there's a lot of things that'll be similar. For Abraham and Isaac, this old covenant, the offspring and the land and being blessing to the world, they shared that in common, and God was doing that in them because God wanted to use them to show who he was to the world. But all that led to Jesus, where God ultimately shows us who he is. The fullness of God dwelled in him. And that was all done in Jesus. And he started a new covenant. So for us, our journey may look similar, but it's different because we're part of a new covenant now that Jesus established. Hebrews 9:15 says, for this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, right? We're not chasing after a piece of land. We're not chasing after millions of descendants. We are looking for something eternal. This new covenant that Jesus set up promises us eternal life with God, new creation. You and I can be new creation. And while it is very tempting to make our lives about the water we find here and now, those who've met with God realize that what he has for us is so much better than anything this world and even this life has to offer. And so we point our lives toward those things, and we don't settle for anything less. And most importantly here, and listen, we don't act like that little boy. We don't grip the things of this life so tightly that they cost us the eternal treasure. When you meet God and realize all that he has offered us through Jesus, you hold on to the pennies of this world much more loosely, and you don't let them destroy the eternal blessings God has for you. You don't spend your first energy pursuing water. You spend it pursuing God. So what does this mean? Like, okay, in practice, what does this mean for you and me? What should my life look like? It means that I stop trying to make time for God in my life, because you don't make time for God in your life. You don't fit him in around your well-digging time, right? You seek him first. When I wake up in the morning, I seek him. Throughout the day, I seek him. It means I ask him to guide me first in everything. There is no decision that's just a no-brainer. I go to God and I say, God, please guide me and lead me. Give me wisdom to see. Help me to know. It means you don't settle with good plans that are short of God's best plans, like Jackie was saying. You know, I'm working, I'm pastoring, things are going well. I feel like there's a next step. Well, let me go get some more education. That's a good plan. God can do something good through that. Absolutely. But she hadn't yet met God. So don't settle down in this good plan of education if what God has for you is something else. Keep pushing till you meet God and let God say to you, yep, this is the place, and give you that peace in your heart. Right? It means that way of thinking about your life, that way of thinking about your job, about where you live, about your family. It means saying, God, I want you to show me and give me a sense of peace. I want to learn how to feel that from you, Lord. I want to pray until I learn how to feel that and know that. I want to fast until, God, you are leading me. It means you start each day praying, talking to God, reading the Bible, so I can know who God truly is and not fall for false, fake counterfeits. And it means you live each day in the presence of God, because that's your home. God's presence is your home. The wells of this world and all the water, it's not your home. Money's not your home. Stuff is not your home. God's presence is home. And simply put, it means exactly what Jesus said it means. It means seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all the other things that we spend so much time worrying about, they'll be added. He'll make sure you have what you need. Seek him first. Let everything else fall in line with that. The Danish philosopher Kierkegaard told a story about this wounded goose who ended up like kind of landing and joining a group of chickens in a farm because he was hurt and he couldn't move very well for a while. So he took up life among the chickens and began to eat with the chickens and enjoy time with the chickens. And after a while, he acted just like all the rest of them. But then months and months and months went by, and one day he heard this weird honk, 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 and you look up and there are these geese flying overhead. And Kierkegaard writes, something began to swell in his breast, to stir within him, something calling him to the skies. And he began to flap his wings that he hadn't used for months and months. And he began to rise up in the air. And then he stopped and he settled back into the mud of the barnyard. He heard the cry, but he settled for less. Don't settle for less than this new creation God has for you. This life, this world, it's going to do everything to come between you and this covenant promise Jesus made, that he would bless us and give us this eternal life, even beginning here and now, not someday far away in some ethereal place. Here and now, you and I can experience life because of what Jesus did. That promise is for right now, to begin experiencing it. Don't settle for other things. Don't let other things get so much a part of your grasp that you can't let them go and you end up missing out, or it ends up costing you the treasure that Jesus has. Go digging into God. Open up the old wells, right, of prayer. Start some new ones in your life that maybe you haven't had there before, of praying, of fasting, of reading the Bible, of serving, of giving generously to care for people, of worshiping. These are wells that help us tap into this life that God has for us. When we do these things, we tap into this life. When we settle for the trickling water of this world, we miss it. Go digging into God and you'll discover living water. Jesus stood up in the middle of Jerusalem one day and he cried out, "Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them." And by this he meant the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were later to receive. This morning we're going to meet God here. Forget about everything else. You don't need to get home. This is home. God's presence is home. Respond the way Isaac did. When he met God, what did he do? He built an altar and he worshiped. Let's build an altar and worship right now. Let's come to Jesus here and now. Let's drink from this water that flows through him, the Holy Spirit. Let's let him fill us up and turn us into rivers ourselves of living water. So would you stand with me?